but it was much more than that. And even the very model depended on cutting edge research, development, and knowledge and skills in ophthalmology. And that's what my father had. He obviously, in partnership with Dr. Jian Rao and all of the other co-founders at the time, he made that sacrifice, and we did as a family. We decided, he and mom said, we're going to move back to Hyderabad.
This is the Indianist podcast, stories of success from leaders and change makers of Indian origin. Why have Indians achieved success across so many different disciplines around the globe? I have no idea, but let's find out together because every story is unique. I'm very excited to have Sita Sonthi with us today. She's the CEO of Space Tango. Space Tango is an industry leader in automated systems in the pursuit of health and technology manufacturing in space. She's also a guest lecturer at MIT. I invited her on this show as I was fascinated by her very unconventional career journey. Welcome, Sita. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Thank you. It's such an honor to have been invited, especially having seen some of the dignitaries that you had got conversations with before. So thank you for including me.
Well, it's our pleasure. Our guests are going to really enjoy this. Sita, our guests are worldwide. As we basically look to chronicling your journey, we're doing this on International Women's Day, also serving as an inspiration and a role model for others. In order to do that, we really want to go right to the beginning, and maybe sometimes in case even before the beginning. So would you tell our listeners really where were you born? Tell us about your parents, what were they doing, if you have any siblings. But let's start with that and then we'll work our way up.
Absolutely. I actually love to tell the story because for a few reasons. One, I was born in Boston in the Dorchester neighborhood at St. Margaret's Hospital, which doesn't exist anymore, but it was the same hospital where the Kennedys were born. So I like to always reference that I share something with some great Americans in the history of the United States. But at the same time, my parents had immigrated from Andhra Pradesh in 1975, and my sister and I were born 2 years and 4 years later, respectively. And of course, what they came to in Boston was the typical Indian immigrant experience in the 70s. My father was doing a fellowship at Tufts in ophthalmology. And my mother at the time was a homemaker, but had a background in chemistry and also a very rich background in the humanities and Sanskrit. And because of their background, their lived experience as first-generation immigrants in whichever neighborhood of Boston they could manage was very different from, I guess, some of the perceptions of what a Kennedy-like experience was like at the same time. So it's that refraction of experiences for my parents that resulted in a lot of, as you can imagine, hard work and sacrifice on their part to have enabled the path that I've been able to be on myself.
Well, that's fantastic. So they came from Andhra Pradesh. They came to Boston because he was a faculty at Tufts. You were born in Boston. Where did you go to school there? Just a your primary school?
So we then moved from Boston to Pittsburgh and then ultimately settled in the suburbs of Chicago. And so I went to primary school at Forest Ridge Academy, a small private Catholic school. It's tiny in the suburbs of Chicago through fourth grade. And the reason it's interesting is what comes next is very untraditional. One of the comments you made earlier is unconventional. What was incredibly unconventional was for a family that immigrated to the United States, finally set up roots in the Chicago area. Both my sister and I were enrolled in elementary school to then pick up and then move back to India. That's what we did. And so my sister and I actually completed elementary and middle school in Hyderabad at an all-girls Muslim school called Nasir. And it couldn't have been more different than the experience at Forest Ridge Academy in terms of culture, in terms of language, in terms of religion, obviously. I mean, they were both actually religious schools. And the irony, of course, is that beneath it all, we are Pakka Telugu Brahmin girls.
That's a lot to unpack. Wow. Their parents moved from Andhra Pradesh to Boston, and then they moved to Pittsburgh, and then to Chicago. I still am trying to figure out, you were there in Chicago. Did just the two of you move to Hyderabad, or did the whole family move back to Hyderabad?
We all did. And this is one of the aspects of actually very full circle of our family history that continues to motivate me is the sacrifice that my father made, but was based on a very specific vision. In Hyderabad in 1988, I think, or 88, 89, so around that time, was the creation of the L.V. Prasad Eye Institute, LVI. So my father was one of the founders. We moved back so he could do that. And it, as an institution, which I'm really honored to know that you're familiar with it, its basic premise as an institution was what folks in the United States might think of as a quote-unquote development project. But it was much more than that. And even the very model depended on cutting-edge research, development, and knowledge and skills in ophthalmology. And that's what my father had. He obviously, in partnership with Dr. Jian Rao and all of the other co-founders at the time, he made that sacrifice, and we did as a family. We decided, he and mom said, we're going to move back to Hyderabad. We found a little flat in Banjara Hills and did exactly what he had set out to do in terms of that vision. And as a result, I would say its impact on me personally was more than just I got to go to school in Hyderabad for a couple of years. It also meant understanding what a broader ecosystem can look like that surrounds you, living in it at a young age, and perhaps relating to one's own culture. Since this is, in fact, the Indianness podcast, I would say I came to a full understanding of how India shaped my identity as a human, especially so because of that particular experience. We had already visited many times, obviously, as a lot of Indian families did at the time. But living there as an elementary school child and going to a school where most of the kids, all girls, were speaking Urdu and I did not speak a lick of it, and having to learn all of that as a budding teenager, that definitely shaped me.
Wow. Like I said, a lot to unpack. I'm still trying to figure that all out. But
me too.
But when Dad decided to move back, what was going through your mind? I mean, obviously, you didn't have a choice. Mom and Dad said, we're going. Dad wants to, and really inspiring because he's giving vision to so many people. People who have never been to some of these camps that are run by hospitals like L.V. Prasad. It is literally giving vision and life to so many. But you were too small to know all of that, all the big altruistic things. What were you thinking? Hey, I'm here. I've got some friends here in Chicago, or maybe not, but at least I understand the system. And now I'm moving back. How was that for you?
Well, it's interesting because, to your point, I was too young to know too much about the impact. So I was young enough to take advantage of what I think of that developmental phase of being a sponge. Conversely, I think the fact that I was in a small academy meant a lot, right? I wasn't in a large school. I also think the fact that by that point, even my sister and I, we started studying Bharatanatyam, Kuchipudi, Telugu, both our language and our culture and our religion at very early ages. So that had already been a big part of that self-identity. And so the move to India was a move. I don't think I really understood its significance at the time, as you were describing. But I also think there were a lot of the choices that both of my parents made to shape our identity and our awareness of our culture, which actually, even at that age, really does set us apart from a lot of Indian Americans. Yeah, now I speak with an American accent, but when I was in India, by the time I left, I didn't. So there's that level of absorption I think had already started, perhaps, before we.
So you were doing Bharatanatyam, absorbing all of this. Was it mom who were the inspiration for all of some of this?
Oh, yeah. 100% mom. I started Bharatanatyam and Kuchipudi when I was 4. My sister was 5.5, 6. And that, by the way, resulted in future years as actually performing for ICCR as an export for global festivals. The level of awareness, knowledge, and culture that all very much came from mom. Mom actually started the first Telugu school in, I think, Illinois back at that same time before we moved. And she, as part of her knowledge and understanding, not just of the language, but also much of the history and culture, was able to pass that on to my generation and now our kids as well. have been impacted by it. So that's very much a credit to Mom, Dr. Sharada Purnasti. I'm going to say her name here too.
Wow. So Mom was a big force, a big inspiration in your growing up. Were you aware what Dad was about? I mean, his profession, what he did, so to speak?
Very much, particularly since in order to understand why we were moving, it was oriented around this hospital, this institute. And we knew that he was an eye doctor. I'll also offer this, of course, within the eras of large televisions and VHS tapes. And there were more than a few very vivid early childhood memories of my sister, City, who is a physician herself. She's a neurologist, a pediatric neurologist. But of her, of she and I sitting in front of those big televisions watching eye surgery VHS videos with Dad. So very familiar with what he did. And we also would have these models of the eye. And there were these plastic models, which at the time, of course, as children, was like the greatest toy to play with. You would piece them apart. You'd see the optic nerve. You would look at the rods and the cones, the retina, the cornea, and you could actually put them back together as a puzzle. Great toys for children, regardless of whether or not you end up in the medical industry, which clearly I didn't, but.
Yeah, well, one out of two. But tell me this, you moved to Banjara Hills. Now, people who don't know Hyderabad, it's Georgetown for Washington, D.C., maybe Beverly Hills for L.A.
It is now.
It wasn't there at that time. Okay, you're in Banjara Hills. How did you end up in this school? I didn't get that connection. Maybe you can explain to our listeners. What was the connection? I'm sure it was a great school. I'm just trying to piece it all together.
Completely. Nasser School is in Khairtabad. And we ended up there because actually the headmistress at the time was a patient at L.B. Prasad, or a patient of my father, and was not only running this private academy, but had an opportunity to see that she had these two essentially American students and was open enough to integrating them into her school. And so the school was a mix of Telugu-speaking, Hindi-speaking, Urdu-speaking, English-speaking kids, all female, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, the full gamut was represented really nicely. And obviously, like, the fact that there was that personal connection allowed for a seamless transition scholastically, because one thing I definitely remember at that stage is the school year in India does not at all map to the school year in the United States. And so as a consequence, you have to figure out, how do you make this transition seamless for kids? She was willing and able to do that. And she sadly very recently passed away, Tahniyat Nizam, but we have this Facebook group, all of my classmates from decades ago, and we're able to honor her in that regard. And I can even stay connected to the point where 6 years ago, I took my kids to see Nasser School so they could see where it was.
So when you went to Nasser School, what was that experience like? I mean, it's relatively still a new environment, even though you were doing Bharatnatyam, Kuchipuri, culture was there, but it's still a little bit of a culture shock, right?
Completely. And it wasn't just culture shock. It was having to study Hindi from scratch and failing. Yeah, I got my first fail. At Nasser School, I'm very proud to say. But I then ended up working that much harder because this is about Indianness after all. And one thing that we always learn from is failure, and we learn fast.
Yep. So As I say, we only have two acceptable grades, A plus and A.
Exactly. See, we have that shorthand that meant others outside of us don't. But it wasn't that I got a B in Hindi, Sanjay. I failed.
The dreaded F word, which never happens. So you were struggling with Hindi. What about friends there? Your sister also went to Nasser School with you, right? So that must have been a little helpful. But any friends that you started making out there? How was that environment?
Absolutely. It was very helpful that my sister was there. I'm also now in touch still with some of the friends that I made at Nasser School, even though we were only there for a couple of years. And I think it was a byproduct of all female. Especially today on International Women's Day, there's a code among us, right? And that's at that very age is when it begins. Also, there would be times, and I remember, hey, American. That's how they would yell at either me or City, my sister. And it wasn't meant to be kind, right? This is schoolyard culture no matter where you are.
Yeah.
So it can happen just among females. It can happen in India, in America, in any neighborhood. This was just the version that we experienced that I recall. And as I said, like feeling Hindi in the classroom, not understanding the Urdu on the playground, all of that factored into, in my case, just a really strong desire to create friendships by hook or by crook. You find a way to identify those who are willing to go along and ride with you. And not everybody would. So that definitely was not an effortless task, but those are folks that I'm still friends with today that I can go and call up if I'm in Bombay or back in Hyderabad or in New York or Sydney. And I have four friends that graduated from my class that are in exactly this location.
New York, Sydney, Hyderabad, Bombay. You covered basically most time zones, but that's good. At that time, I mean, looking back, obviously, it seems pretty cool. Was it a little tough, or what do you think it has kind of made you go into an environment where you think, hey, I can work with anybody, or I can figure out a way to kind of get my point across? Do you think that has helped in any way?
Well said. I think that's exactly what it's done. And the fact that it happened at early enough ages, I think is one reflection I've had, having since lived in now a total of 9 countries. That doesn't include places where I've visited for short stints. But as I've gotten older, it's obviously harder to adapt to a new environment. And it's harder to not absorb the pain of being treated as an other, much less go into a brand new environment and think, as you said, I'm gonna figure this out, and I'm going to treat it almost as a blank canvas that I can paint the way that I want to. I think, luckily, I was both born with some of that mindset, thanks to the good genetics and the very effective protection and nurturing by mom and dad. But at the same time, as you get older, that's harder to do and treat the new environment as a blank canvas. So I'd say now I'm like on the middle-aged side of many of those learnings. But at that stage, yeah, it was tough. It was absolutely challenging. What I would argue, however, is coming back to America was much more challenging.
Well, we're going to get to that. You said you have a blank canvas that you can paint it any way you wanted, and which you did, and you got 4 good friends out of it. How were the academics at Nasser?
Oh, the academics were phenomenal, other than the Hindi, of course. Which I ended up, right, like being motivated enough by that F to catch up. I also remember this was at a time when if you were advanced enough in either a language or in a math or in a science, then you could take an entrance exam and you could take that class. I studied algebra in 5th grade, right? They don't give algebra in 5th grade in the United States. And that's certainly that what I would call institutional flexibility or plasticity no longer applies here. I don't know if it does in India. I don't know if it does at Nasser School, but I do know, generally speaking, in educational systems, if you can showcase an aptitude for something, then you are allowed the opportunity to prep, to push yourself beyond what the rubric requires. And so I was able to take advantage of that on a math basis for sure. And that was really neat because that actually meant I could be challenged by the math content at a really extraordinary level, especially in an environment which was all girls. Because for all of the commentary globally about the importance of promoting girls in a STEM education setting, I can say with great confidence, been there, done that, got the t-shirt. You know?
So it was pretty rigorous. After Nasser, what was the next journey? Tell our listeners what happened after Nasser. And when did you leave Nasser?
So my parents basically made this decision that it was time to bring Siddhi and me back to the United States for educational purposes. And Siddhi was in 7th grade, Siddhi was in 8th grade, myself in 7th grade. And we came back to the suburbs of Chicago. Of course, by this point, that age difference is so huge for child development, especially for females, especially in a scholastic setting. And you would think that we would just pick right up where we left off. But oh no, being a teenager in America is challenging enough, even if you've been here the whole time. Being a teenager in America with, I'll just go ahead and say it, not learning about shaving and waxing, not learning about losing your accent, not learning about Vanilla Ice and The Simpsons. I remember these cultural touchstones of that time that were such big problems that needed to be solved. And it was hard. That was much harder coming back. But obviously, in hindsight, I understand why they did that. And I'm glad that they did.
But they came back because of both of you. And Dad also moved back. All of you did. But you said the transition was much harder because of some of the things that you mentioned, vanilla ice and some of these other things. Absolutely. And just as a social comment, I will say it's gotten even worse with social media and everything else. Sita, I completely empathize with what you went through, but heck, man, the peer pressure now that teenagers go through is just mind-boggling. But coming back to you, how was school and were you able to make some friends back in Chicago?
Yes, I completely agree. The canvas now is almost too populated because of social media. And I have two teenagers now, and I'm very much reliving a lot of those adaptation challenges through them. And I'm so relieved that we didn't have that component at the time. And yeah, we did make friends. I did make friends, and I'm still in touch with some of them now as well. One might say Generation X, like we were on the tail edge of it, and we're potentially the last true beneficiaries of social media because we remembered what it was like without it. But many of my friendships I've been able to sustain and almost reestablish with friends at that time because of social media, right? But I say that, and I also want to paint a very accurate picture of identity at this time. By this point, we were practicing dance every single day when we lived in India. And we had already been performing at festivals at that age around India. We'd been performing for ICCR. And it was this unique story, which actually got written about in many papers, Indian Express, The Hindu, you name it, Times of India. My mom and I, we still have all the clippings. But I remember this one critic from Bangalore who came to one of our performances and was lamenting not the performance and the dedication and the knowledge that we put our blood, sweat, and tears into, but the fact that we were almost this, what's the expression, bizarre export, right? We were American. And by we, I mean my sister and I, performing Bharatanatyam and Kuchipudi on behalf of some of the most well-known dance academies in India for Indian audiences, for the Indian government. And yet we were being criticized just by being American. I still have that clipping, and that shaped my identity coming back to the United States because it made me think, well, if I'm just seen as an American, but I know the Bharatanatya Shastra inside and out there, but then I come back here, let me just flex what I know. Kind of going back to a comment you made earlier about figuring it out, it was very hard to create friendships with American kids at Homewood Flossmoor High School in the suburbs of Chicago as a Bharatanatyam classical dancer. The terms of engagement are football, soccer, parties, yes, extracurricular activities, debate. And so I sort of went into the arts because it seemed like the most natural extension from Bharatanatyam and Kuchipudi. But deep down inside, I wanted to be on a sports team because that would have enabled a more...
friendships.
Exactly.
More popularity, more friendships, while you are, on the other hand, working towards your Arangetram, probably.
We did that actually years before.
Did?
Yeah.
Wow. For our listeners who don't know, that's like the ultimate graduation. Sita is basically subtly trying to tell you that she's way advanced, but that's for another show. We'll talk about her dance prowesses. You were a kid coming from India at that point. I mean, gone, come back, who was more interested in dancing, etc. So you were you didn't fit in. Is that what the issue was there? Because it's Chicago suburb. This was not like Chicago, Gandhi Street or etc. So how was that? What did that make you feel?
It was tough. It was exactly as you said. Like, I think every teenager struggles to fit in. Both of my kids have that challenge now. And there'd be right, everyone, no matter where you are. My color was exactly as you described. It was standing out, but not in a way that you could be seen. It was standing out in a way that no one really saw you, right? And the exception to that would be on occasion if Sidi and I would actually perform at high school. And we did that once or twice. And then suddenly it was to be seen through the lens that was very specific. And at the same time, it meant I just focused on my academics and dance. And lo and behold, I graduated. You can fast forward and there were, and it really was even doing exams early so that I could fly back to Madras or Hyderabad to perform for festivals in the middle of high school. So this, like, the nature of your podcast resonated with me at its title from the get-go, because the nature of how I identify with my Indianness is so layered and data populated in a way that doesn't necessarily happen for a lot of Indian Americans. Even going through American high school, trying to adapt or readapt to social, cultural, gender norms at that time, we were still going back to India frequently to practice, perform, tour, festival, etc.
Wow. Let me unpack that. Wow. And was it you and your sister, or mom was also there?
Mom was also there for sure. Although sometimes Siddhi and I would go by ourselves. By the time we would get old enough, we could travel on our own. And we would go with our guru. We would meet them there and just practice and perform. I remember one, I think I was a sophomore, and I was in two advanced placement classes or something. And so they have very strict timelines for when you have to take your test. And I asked to take them early, if they would proctor them early so that I could leave for India. I remember that season very vividly. And I didn't get an F.
Wow. Were you doing this on your own, or was mom nudging you or pushing this? This was something that you and your sister were kind of, you wanted to do this?
By this point, I mean, when we were 4 and 5 and 6, obviously, we were nudged into it. By this point, we were choreographing our own pieces. I mean, this was not just self-driven, but it was self-taught, self-designed. And we had a guru and colleagues in the academy, Lasipri Academy with Kuchipudi and Bharatanatyam. And we were teaching kids from time to time. We would go during the summer, right? And spend a couple of weeks there and on our own living with our guru. And that experience, again, even though we were, by this point, we're back in America, spending summers in those formative years in Lakrikapul, in the flats with Umarti, I mean, that's, there are very formative experiences, and that is chief among them. And learning how to have that, I would say, constant pliability, right? It was ongoing. It wasn't a one-off.
So you could switch between let's just say McDonald's fries, and quickly go back there to your guru, perform, no problems, and then come back and then go and come back. Do you think that's, and I've asked this before, this moving, I didn't realize that there was so much moving, has given you that ability to be flexible, resilient? As you said, as we grow older, it gets a little harder and harder. But man, wow. I mean, you are doing this, and you and your sister were kind of doing this on your own, as you said. Was dance something that you found a peace in there? What attracted you to, I'm just trying to figure out, because you made a lot of sacrifices, taking early exams, flying 20 hours, man, and probably not a direct flight to Chennai at that point. So long flights, but doing it, what was it about dance and this that kind of attracted you or attracts you? I mean, I'm just trying to figure that out.
It still very much applies. As I like to think of it, it's probably the first language, right? It's the first way that we as humans developed to try to tell stories. You think about the corollaries with sign language. You think about the ways that the Navarasas, the 9 facial expressions that can convey these basic 9 emotions, which are written into the Bharatanatya Shastra. There's a reason that makes sense no matter what country you live in, no matter what language you speak. There's a reason that someone from any country could watch a performance, not know the story, but understand the sentiment, right? That was a gift. And to be able to understand the foundational principles of it at an age, to be able to tell stories in that way, continues to be something that moves me very much. And by the way, it doesn't just have to be an artistic endeavor, a passion, a non-for-profit. it is incredibly helpful in industry, right? To be able to tell stories in a way that is understandable to somebody on the other side requires a deep reservoir of empathy and the Navarasas. You heard it here first. So there definitely was a passion behind it, as well as, I will say this, I remember learning some of the most complicated rhythmic passages with my Mrudangam artist. And we would actually compose some of these complicated rhythms together, right? As part of choreography. That's all math. The math part of my brain absolutely loved it. And it was like Morse code. It was like storytelling through zeros and ones, right? There's early examples at the most basic root level of storytelling for persuasion, for negotiation, for empathy, for conveying sadness, for conveying aggression, as well as the simplification of complex patterns and to be able to understand them and then recreate them. These are memories that absolutely got me going every single day. And the fact that I could say, this is all from India, you guys, like this was written 500 years ago, was super compelling to me, as much as it informed my identity.
Wow. As a non-dancer, I've never heard such incredible expressions of dance that you can, obviously, it has allowed you to become a great storyteller or persuasive person or marketing or getting your vision across. But maybe it has also given you some level of discipline, because dance is not, people think, hey, you just get up and dance. It's a lot of practice and discipline. So was there ever a thought in your mind that maybe I want to just be a dancer?
I am so glad you asked, because this is actually a very important part of my unconventional story. I went to college. I studied political science and economics, so humanities field, which in and of itself was obviously different from the medicine pharmacy path that is expected for us.
The two profession rules, Sita.
I know.
Doctor and engineer.
And I broke it. And that was after Siti, my sister, got admitted to the HPME Advanced Medicine Program at Northwestern, right? I already broke the two profession rule. I left Chicago. I went to Amherst. So I went away from home. I broke that rule. I studied something completely different. But here's the thing. When I graduated, and I graduated summa cum laude from a college that had only 20 years before started admitting females, I worked my butt off in two majors, one of which was economics. So I was studying very advanced math. At the end of it, I applied for 6 graduate programs. And at the time, I was convinced by that point, whatever I'm doing, it's international. International relations, journalism, finance, doesn't matter. I will be in and of the world. And it should come as no surprise that I still consider that very much part of who I am as a leader. But I was going to study international relations. I applied to 6 programs. I got rejections from almost every single one, because I was only 20 years old. I was young because I skipped kindergarten, but age mattered. I didn't have field experience, which, of course, they weren't counting these countless weeks, months on end of actually professional experience in that category as a child professional. But furthermore, I got rejections from 5 schools, but I got admitted to the 6th. That was Johns Hopkins, which was ironically the first one to get into. But here's the rub. Before I got that rejection letter, I got the acceptance. I had 5 rejections. At that point, at the end of college, my off-ramp was literally a master's degree in international finance or economics at Johns Hopkins, or move back to Hyderabad and teach Bharatanatyam full. It is the most unconventional off-ramp possible, but that was actually the binary for me. And to this day, my daughter, actually, it's really interesting. She was watching an old video of me performing for the Dalai Lama on YouTube. She finds my YouTube dance video.
You perform for the Dalai Lama. We need to get to that.
You can find that on YouTube.
We will.
It was her. So she's the age that I was when I did that performance. So she was just watching it. And she said, Mom, can you teach me that? And I was like, of course I can. Are you kidding me? And it opened something in me, Sanjay, that I thought, yeah, could I have made that same choice now that I was prepared to make 24, 25 years ago? Absolutely. Absolutely, I would.
You would?
The economics of my family made sense, absolutely.
So We talk a lot about inflection points here. Do you think, I think Johns Hopkins is a great university. It's in my backyard, but you think that maybe if you'd become a dance teacher, that would have been a better choice for you?
No, I don't believe in better or worse. I believe in the multiverse. In the multiverse, there's a version of me that was teaching this whole time and created my own academy and extended the principles that were taught to me by Dr. Umar Amarao, my guru at La Cipria, that extended to me the tenets that were taught to me by my mother about the value of learning Sanskrit, all of the Vedas, of being able to translate those into stories that are both understood by our own, but also more importantly by others, and showcasing how the power of the storytelling and the premises and the discipline that you very rightfully pointed out can have application in other settings. I don't think it's better or worse. I just could very easily have seen that being the outcome.
Your choice of career or going in this direction, how was dad and mom? Were they okay with that?
We joke about this. They came actually for last Thanksgiving. And interestingly, I had two of my colleagues from Hopkins at the Friendsgiving table that I invited. They were living in the area. And one of them asked, like, so you guys weren't always supportive of Sita studying something other than medicine, etc. When I graduated Hopkins, by that point, I knew that I'd already been admitted to the Foreign Service of the United States, which from an Indian perspective, the IFS, of course, is an extremely prestigious institution. Same applies doubly so in the United States, especially because, by the way, the Foreign Service wasn't exactly made up of folks like this, right? But once I got in, then it started clicking, especially for dad. Oh, wow, that's cool. That's impressive. That's prestigious. I get it now.
Only 10 years later. But anyway, that's okay. But that's fine. But was international a choice because you were at heart a global citizen, really, to be very frank with you. And that's what you wanted to do. And do you think Johns Hopkins was a good choice for you? How was your experience at JHU? I mean, were you at SAIS?
I was at SAIS, exactly.
Yeah, great institution.
Extraordinary. I mean, there are things that you can take credit for. Yeah, I managed to get into the school. But then there are things that you just say you were the beneficiary of some tremendous luck and the credit of the institution. My SAIS experience was extraordinary. It was hard. It was much more challenging than Amherst. And Amherst was really hard too. These are challenging institutions for a reason. But SAIS enabled me actually to look towards the Middle East. It opened the door. It opened that door for research. I did a research fellowship in Tunisia. And I actually wrote about the history, the uprising of Islamism in political action in the history of Tunisia in the summer of 2001, months before 9/11. I published it. I wrote it and did all my research in French, actually. But what was interesting was I would never have even thought to go to Tunisia were it not for that program at that institution and Professor Zartman, who was my conflict management advisor, thinking you have been in environments before. By the way, I went to a Muslim girls' school. Maybe there's some of that very early seat knowledge that can enable you to fit in an environment like Tunisia where, yeah, you don't speak Arabic. You'll get there. Speak French. That kind of thinking and pushing from really strong, smart practitioners and mentors and researchers and big thinkers, you need to be surrounded by them. And I was really lucky to have been surrounded by them in SAIS for sure.
Did you think that you'd found your place when you went to SAIS? I mean, because sometimes the light bulb goes off that this is really what I want to do, or this is where I want to be. Or maybe that was not SAIS, or maybe Foreign Service, it's a space tango. Who knows?
I had a huge light bulb go off then. And I will say the light bulb at Amherst was, I'm a systems thinker. Like, I now have nomenclature for it. I didn't have the nomenclature at that time, but said I think in big terms and I can observe multiple phenomena occurring at the same time and try to deduce some patterns and come up with some hypotheses on the back of that systems thinking, right? Now I know what that means. But I had some of those aha moments in college. What SAIS enabled me to do was, okay, we're going to give you ideas of where to go apply it. And it's going to be in the world. And it's going to be to solve problems like the Dutch disease and overdependency on the oil industry in Nigeria. It's going to be the rise of Islamism in Tunisian political thought. It's going to be all of these things. And then you can figure out on the basis of who you are, which environment you fit in, or maybe deduce that, as you said, you're a global citizen. You can solve that problem there. Solve that problem there. And if you can communicate well enough and earn the trust of the folks on the other side of the table, then you're not just coming in opining, solving a problem and then walking away, but you actually maybe earn their trust to help execute as well.
After you graduated from SAIS, you joined the Foreign Service, where, as you said, not too many people like you. How was that experience?
Extraordinary, extraordinary. And people often ask me why I left, when I left, etc. The short answer is many of my postings were in hardship locations, and I would have had to have done a posting without my kids. And that was not a choice that I was willing to make. And others have, and I applaud them. That was not a choice that fit me, who I was at that stage in my life. So I ended up having to leave, because at some point you have to say, are you going to go to Iraq or are you going to join industry? go back to Iraq, because I'd already served. But all things being equal, I would have never left. All things being equal, my kids and I, we would be somewhere in some overseas posting now. But as I said, in the multiverse, there's a version of me that stayed in the Foreign Service. And the beauty of service is you can serve in so many different environments using some of the same learnings, as long as you're still committed to serving. You can still lead in other environments using some of the same learnings, as long as you're still committed to leading with humility. And that's what I'd love to say I continue to do in industry, with always the caveat that if called upon to serve, I have been a couple of times since I left. Eventually, probably when both of my kids are in college, maybe I go.
I started the podcast by saying you've had some unusual career choices. How did you end up at Space Tango? You're running a space company, and that's pretty interesting. Maybe last week or so, we had on our podcast, she runs the UN space program. Great, yeah, great programs. But I find that very fascinating, and I'm running into a lot of space folks, especially International Women's Day. So how did you end up there? Because that's not typical just for anybody.
I agree. I'm honored that somehow my path ended up here. We call ourselves the Space Daisies. So that's like a new hashtag. We're trying to make it big. Because the more you look, the more you see NASA, UN, various companies in the private industry, commercial, civil, etc. We have contributed so much to, and I don't include myself in this category. I'm just the beneficiary of being in the same club, but contributed to so much knowledge and learning in the advancement of the technology. How I ended up here, from the Foreign Service, a lot of the work that is performed between the aerospace industry of the United States and foreign countries is executed through what are called foreign military sales. It's basically the sale of FMS, the use or sale of U.S. manufactured technology. Satellites, launch vehicles are components of what used to be and still are in certain cases governed by the FMS system, shall we say. At a higher strategic level, you have to think through the transfer of technology and when the transfer of technology and knowledge is beneficial for national security and what limitations ought to be put on it as well to be able to preserve national security. I've honored to have said that in my Foreign Service career, I took part in some pretty complex decision-making and policy-making in that setting. That enabled me to learn a lot about the technology, at least at a high enough level to be able to negotiate about it on behalf of the United States people and government. And long story short, knowledge of aircraft like the F-16 or satellite manufacturing or launch vehicles, launch spaceport facilities, that technical knowledge was enough, plus my understanding of what successful outcomes can look like in partnership with the United States government to enable a transition to industry. So I spent some time at Raytheon, then a vice president at Sierra Nevada Corporation, head of human spaceflight at SpaceX, head of the commercial space topic at Boston Consulting Group, and now Space Tango. It was all industry roles, but that have basically bridged the gap, I won't say gap, but I guess the gap between my personal chapter in government and an industry leveraging the knowledge that I had on a lot of what are now sort of typical space-based assets.
Fantastic experiences. I have a feeling there is a dance symphony somewhere in the middle of all of that, but that's a different episode. Sita, when you look back at your journey, and it's just an amazing journey, if you were to pick one or two key inflection points, and this is for our listeners who are looking at you as a role model, which one would you pick, one or two key inflection points?
I'll definitely pick two, given the opportunity. The first one is one that I mentioned already, but it's so rooted in who I am, is the ability to say, okay, if I don't get into Hopkins, I'm going back to Hyderabad. Hopkins or Hyderabad, right? And it was Hyderabad to dance very specifically. I think the reason that that matters to me so much is it's not just knowing what to do when you're presented with an inflection point, but it's also having the neuroplasticity to feel like either outcome is okay. One isn't better. That's not easy to do. That becomes harder and harder as I get older. But I've had enough of these inflection points that you just have to stay incredibly neuroplastic. The other one I would mention is, as I said, like I had the opportunity to move to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, but I would, based on the structure of my family at the time, I would have had to be without my kids. And that actually meant and resulted in leaving the Foreign Service, which was my life, my talk about identity. It was what enabled me to be the full leader and professional and service member of both America and in some cases India that I prided myself on being, and I had to give it all up. But I wouldn't change the outcome for a minute because I'm also, first and foremost, a single mother of two teenagers. And given the choice over and over again, I'll pick them.
So for our listeners, what she's saying is when she decided to pick, Johns Hopkins to Hyderabad, and she said either would have been okay. So sometimes we are presented with choices and we need to make the best of them. And sometimes they turn out to be actually better than you had imagined because you didn't know what was in store for you after Johns Hopkins. You could never have planned. And then again, you had a choice in Jeddah, Foreign Service, family, etc. And you made some hard choices and you said you'd do that again too. Those are great insights for our listeners. Tell me, Sita, now, obviously you're still very young, but let's just say if you were to talk to Sita, if that's me coming out of Johns Hopkins, what would be one or two key pieces of advice that you would give? Because this is for our listeners in many ways.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. I would actually be my characteristic self. I'd say it's not going to get any easier. But I would say you absolutely have what it takes, so don't worry. Every step that you don't think you have what it takes, you're going to prove yourself wrong. I know that's almost too personal. Maybe that's not sort of broadly applicable, but I'll just offer at that stage in my life, I really did feel like everything was available to me. I mean, I graduated, I was 22, I think, with a master's from Hopkins. I could have done anything. And I felt that way too. I think as life goes on, maybe this is probably a better way to answer your question. Life will present obstacles, for sure. When life presents obstacles to you, keep going. Don't worry about what is on the other side, because there will be so much more on the other side. And it's not as though it's just one canvas. There's more canvases, and you can keep painting fresh ones each time.
That's probably what I would say.
If life presents you obstacles, don't worry, because there will be options and sometimes better options than you even think. That's a great message for our listeners. Sita, in our lightning round, we just asked for very brief answers for you. And you kind of have addressed, because I can't find somebody who is maybe more an epitome of Indianness. But if you were to give our listeners just your, because we asked that to everybody, what is your brief definition of Indian? I mean, you are Indianness personified, really. Any of our guests have come in, you are as personified as anybody.
My brief definition is religion. It is understanding the Vedas fundamentally and finding that one nugget in the Vedas that you put into practice every day. for me, I practice yoga regularly. But as an example, like it's finding something foundational for me that's the Vedas and finding a piece of the foundation that you practice every day.
Finding a piece of the Vedas that you can practice every day. That's great. If you were to pick one person, and I'm saying one person, I have a feeling I know who you're going to say, who's been the most influential, and has to be only one, in your journey so far, who would you pick?
My dad.
I knew that. Of course.
Arnold.
If Nike's tagline is just do it, what is Sita's? I have a little guess on that too, but we'll ask you.
Lead with service.
I didn't think of that, but that's fantastic. Lead with service. Oh, that's wonderful. Very briefly, Sita, you still have so much more to accomplish. Where do you, and you kind of have hinted at this once the kids grow up, where do you see her journey going from here? This is again for our listeners who are thinking, hey, she's done it all. What else is there? She's danced. She's gone to a multivariate school. She's been all over the world.
I would love to actually spend an entire year in a meditation environment. I haven't done that yet. That's not a bucket list thing. That's more of a, I'm going to need that after the complexity that life has thrown at me, that my family has thrown at me, and that these many chapters have thrown at me. So that's one thing that is important to me to both give voice to and execute for myself and as a very selfish matter. After I have my year of selfish silence, I absolutely want to return to a life of service. And that can be as a diplomat. That can also be as a community member in some other community. It can be in America. It could be in India. It could be in Uganda. It could be anywhere. But I do want to return to a life of pure service.
1 year of meditation retreat, I can go for that. And then life of service. And I see Ambassador Santi to India, maybe. That could be pretty cool. That could
be from cool. Your lips to someone's ears.
Well, we have a lot of people in DC who listen from the administration too. You'd be surprised. But Sita, knowing how busy you are, this has been just incredible, especially on this day. Your journey is inspirational, full of surprises. And I've learned a lot, as I said, here to Banjara Hills to back and so many other places. I'm sure we didn't touch on a lot of many crazy journeys that you've had, but very inspirational. Thanks so much for being open with us, and thanks so much for sharing.
Thank you, Sanjay. As I said, it is International Women's Day. We can't be leaders as women without allies like you to shine the light on our stories. I also thank you for taking me down memory lane and giving credence where it's due and recognizing it in the form of my parents, because none of this is possible without the sacrifices that they made. So thank you. Thank you for inviting me to join and putting me in a category of some really extraordinary people.
Thank you, because you really, your story needs to be told. Thank you so much. And thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to the Indianist podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and subscribe to enjoy future inspirational stories.